Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, poets C.M. Burroughs and Adrian Mateka discuss the groundbreaking legacy of poet Melvin Dixon. This conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Okay, welcome to our next program here on the partner stage at the American Writers Festival. This program is presented by our valued festival sponsor, the Poetry Foundation, who we thank for their support of this event. Poet Melvin Dixon wrote movingly of black gay culture, of men on the margins fighting for their lives as the AIDS epidemic ravaged beautiful communities of creativity. This program looks at his groundbreaking legacy and lasting influence. And here to talk about him are C.M. Burroughs, Associate Professor of Creative Writing at Columbia College Chicago and author of The Vital System and Master Suffering, and Adrian Mateka, author of 5 collections of poetry, most recently Somebody Else Sold the World, and editor of Poetry Magazine. Welcome to you both.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming out today. All right, so I'm going to begin by reading the introduction I wrote for this copy of the journal, Poetry Journal, that contains the Melvin Dixon folio. And this is called Poetic Kin, Meeting Melvin Dixon. My first exposure to Melvin Dixon's work was in the summer of 2009 when my friend Sean Singer emailed me Dixon's poem, Blood Positive, to motivate me as I revised new poems. I was largely writing in first person at the time and revising poems that interrogated vulnerable bodies. Dixon's use of the second person pronoun and allusion to the AIDS epidemic pulled me out of my seat. There are stakes in Dixon's poem, whole lives in immediate peril, and so Blood Positive reminded me to identify what was at stake in my poems as I labored over revisions. The following poem is the first I read by Dixon. This is called Blood Positive. 1, the children wonder. What did you do when the thighs of our brothers were nothing but bruises and bones? Where did you go when the songs said to march and you only meandered and minced? Whom did you kiss with your cough and elaborate phlegm? How much time did you borrow on blood? What was the price of your fear and your fist? Don't move, your memory or your life. 2, the dead speak. Leave us alone. We did nothing but worship our kind. When you love as we did, you will know there is no life but this, and history will not be kind. Now take what you need and get out. Dixon wrote in various genres, including poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and translation. He was bad, y'all. He earned his BA in American Studies from Wesleyan in 1971 and a PhD in the Philosophy of American Civilization from Brown University in 1975. His excellence as a scholar and writer led him to a career in academia. He was a professor of literature at Queens College from 1980 until he died in 1992. Although the most crucial element of his creative and scholarly texts is the exploration of memory and his geography in African American and Black diaspora cultures, Dixon enriches his work by centering gay Black men as subjects, characters, and speakers. Vanishing Rooms, 1991, his second novel, revolves around the murder of a gay man in New York City and chronicles the lives of 3 people deeply affected by his death. His second book of poems, Love's Instruments, 1995, foregrounds the life of gay men suffering and dying from AIDS. Dixon rendered lives that were subject to erasure, not the least of which was his own. He died from complications due to AIDS. Poets, including Elizabeth Alexander, assured that his work was not lost. Alexander wrote the introduction to his posthumously published Love's Instruments. In 2012, I was a new faculty member at Columbia College Chicago and creating a graduate seminar focused on marginalized bodies. Marginalization often calls race to mind first, but I wanted to represent sexuality, socioeconomics, disability, and illness. This semester eschewed the idea of not conflating a poet with her poems and dug deeply into a concept I'd recently seen Adrian Matika articulate on Twitter, aka X, formerly, I don't know. Of all places, that aesthetics and identity in poetry are linked because the poet is experimenting with both simply by writing a poem. The linkage of aesthetics and identity describes Dixon's thorough poetic representation of the lives of gay men and his life as a gay black man. Dixon's poetry consistently arrests me with its impassioned focus on the body in love, illness, labor, and the endless personal and collective grief of the AIDS epidemic. I taught Dixon's love instruments for the first time that year with other books including Tori Dent's HIV Mon Amour, Spencer Reese's The Clerk's Tale, Claudia Rankine's Don't Let Me Be Lonely, and Teresa Hakuncha's Dicti. By the time I began teaching his works, Dixon's two books of poetry, Change of Territory and Love's Instruments, weren't widely available. But I taught the latter from time to time and always thought, someone has to republish these in a single volume. After reading a posthumously published collection of poems by Christopher Gilbert, I wondered, why not me? I desired the book. I couldn't wait for it to be made for me. So in 2017, I wrote to Dr. Justin A. Joyce, the co-editor with Dwight McBride of a collection of Melvin Dixon's essays on literature and life titled A Melvin Dixon Critical Reader, if you're interested in those other types of works outside of poetry. So Joyce became my partner ultimately in creating this volume of poetry. I went to the Schomburg Library, Schomburg Center for African American Research in New York City to look for poetry that maybe was not published in the books. Reviewing his work was my first time doing archival research. It felt magical and wonderful to be holding things that he held and touching paper that he had scrawled little notes to himself on. There was a particularly brilliant discovery, which seems pretty innocuous, but it was a tiny little notebook, and in this notebook he'd written ideas for renovating his three-story house. And he'd have things like reupholster the couch in Demas fabric, or, you know, refinish granddad's chair, things like this that were really personal. And there's the poetry, but then there's also the person that's just living day to day in the world. Lastly, Dixon's work has been with me for the last 14 years, and this is my first opportunity to share what I've long loved with a wide audience. I've compiled and ordered a section of poems in this issue, few of which are available today, and I hope you'll be able to pick up a subscription of poetry and or this journal and check it out. I'm going to read two poems, and then I'll turn it over to Adrian. Okay, The 80s Miracle Diet. Yours free without the asking. Quick delivery via overnight mail. Special handling or 10-year incubation. How I lost 40 pounds in 2 weeks. Cocktails of Perrier with a twist of AZT. Bactrim broiled with bacon bits. Egg lipid quiche for brunch. Our tongues ablaze on toast points in a soundless bolt howl. The most talented minds, the best bodies of my generation, going up in smoke. Act now. Dial 1-800-I-GOT-IT-TOO. Our operators are standing by. I have photographs to prove it before and after and passed away. Spring cleaning. First goes the floor dust, then newspaper stacked near the bed. Peanut shells swept out of hiding between mattress and rug, toenails clipped, sprouts of a beard shaved off. With hourly glasses of Deer Park water and the barest of food, the body sheds winter fat and filler. The hair goes next, close to the gleaming, gleaming skull. You are ready for the sun and the salt-tongued air. You are someone new. I will be someone new. Like you, and promise not to hear the rattle our bones make moving from empty closets and all through the room. Thanks.
set. Peace, everybody. It's so good to see you here. Thank you for joining us to celebrate Melvin Dixon and also just the phenomenon of queer black poetry. I used to work at a bookstore when I was an undergraduate, so I found Melvin Dixon's first book there. Had no idea who he was, didn't know anything about it, and was mesmerized by both the voice, but also the experience that he was trying to convey, because this is a scholar, this is an intellectual, this is a person who has a wide range of interests and imaginaries, and you can see it in the poems. He is a fluent French speaker. He lived in France for a while, so there's a whole different world for me. This boy from Indiana, reading, you know, I didn't know that black people did things like that, right? We were, in my house, we were, you know, we'd go on vacation once a year to Iowa, you know, so the idea that we could be welcome other places, like that there's an entire diaspora, was extraordinary to me. But when I was thinking about what I wanted to say about Melvin Dixon, I think we are so fortunate now that medicine and science have given us some tools to deal with HIV in ways. But for those who weren't around back then in the early 90s, like late 80s, early 90s, it was terrifying, absolutely terrifying, because if you got this, then you were going to die. That was it. And so to see someone living that experience and through their poems, sharing that experience with other people is just so vital, and I'm so glad that you're going to be putting these poems back out in the world in a different way. So because I'm the editor of this magazine, I didn't write anything for the folio, but I wanted to read something that someone else wrote. Cyrus Cassells, who's a beautiful poet and was a close friend of Melvin Dixon, wrote a commemoration of him for this. So I'm going to read that and a couple of poems, and then we can talk a little bit more and answer some questions, okay? Yeah, and if you don't know Cyrus's work, you should check it out. He's a phenomenal poet. It's called On Melvin Dixon, Vivacity and Witness. Besides being eloquent and courageous, Melvin was a vivacious man, one of the most alive people I've ever known, and had a wonderful blend of cosmopolitan erudition, blazing humor, and down-home wisdom. It was my windfall and profound privilege to be on hand for these pivotal moments in his life. Before meeting him in the flesh, I served as an anonymous reader and an advisor for his first book, Poems, Change of Territory, which is the one that I found and was just, it's so good. I hope that you can read it. It thrilled me with its unfettered queer candor and vivid descriptions of North Carolina, my mother's home state. Later, by chance, in the fall of 1983, we were invited to read together at the 92nd Street Y. Melvin proved to be a dynamic and impressive reader in his own verse, bringing the Southern world, the Piedmont of the poems, to full life. In 1985, I was visiting novelist Michael Cunningham in Provincetown when Melvin and his partner Richard Horvitz showed up as prospective buyers. I happily vouched for the two of them, and they ended up purchasing Michael's place. My friendship with Melvin and Richard blossomed then, and we became neighbors on Cape Cod, sharing both local and literary gossip. Melvin's physicality and pealing laughter, our animated times together on his sunny deck overlooking the lapis of Provincetown Harbor, still remain incredibly easy to summon. Richard was an administrator for the Ford Foundation, and he and Melvin spent significant periods of time in Dakar, which enhanced Melvin's salient work as an able translator and scholar of African literature. I loved hearing Melvin's stories about Senegalese culture. In 1992, I was in the audience at Outright in Boston when a spellbound Melvin delivered, a short time before his death, his fearless and rousing speech, "I'll be somewhere listening for my name." It's in this issue of the magazine, and it's available online. The speech is significant and pops up in quite a bit of queer literature when people are looking back at this time. They talk about this speech as being really important. All right. This was a both deeply and inspiring and devastating as he spoke candidly about Richard's death and his own harsh struggle with AIDS. The speech was both a rallying cry in that era of ACT UP and a stirring challenge to the audience to live more truthfully and more decisively in a time of grave crisis for our beleaguered community. We did our best, our utmost, Melvin and I, in our second volumes, Love's Instruments and Soul Makes the Path go Through Shouting, respectively, to hear, to be cogent witnesses, to find arrow-sure language for the love and catastrophe we were living through in the premier decades of the decade of the AIDS pandemic. There's a poem in here that Cyrus wrote for Melvin Dixon. I'm not going to read it, but I hope that you will. I'm just going to keep talking about Melvin's poems today, if that's okay. What would the irreplaceable Melvin have made of the 21st century America? I know he would have decried the emperor as made of awfulness of Trump and the MAGA phenomenon. He would have rejoiced at RuPaul's dynamic drag ambassadorship, despite the current anxious cycle of drag demonization. And he would have cheered up when our friend, black queer poet John Keane, received the MacArthur Fellowship and gave an inspiring speech at the National Book Awards. Let me express to C.M. Burroughs and to Poetry Magazine my heartfelt thanks for this compelling folio in celebration of Melvin's important, indelible work. In honor of Melvin's achievements as a poet, novelist, translator, activist, and scholar, in honor of the fire and the lifelong beauty of our youth together, I reach across time and space, three decades, to say to my fabulous cohort and literary peer, well written, well translated, well fought, well lived. Isn't that nice? Like, what? I hope somebody can say something like that about me. Like, I'm thinking of, like, yeah, you know, he was pretty cheap. Like, I can't imagine that anybody would have anything that glorious to say, but we should all hope for that, right? That some friend sees us that way. So I want to read two of Melvin's poems, and then we can sit and talk a bit more. This one is called Getting Your Rocks Off, and they're both going to be from the issue. Reading clouds beyond the road, I calculate our distance, survey the space between our clothes where rising curves and mountain tug for air, touch, release. You drive to the hairpin slope, hesitate, turn up and in. We ride on every naked fear you have and discover that men like us are not all granite, shale, deceptive quartz, or glittering layers of mica. From here, you see the whole world differently, brown skin, tufts of black grass. And many times I have given myself to summits like these. Ride in, ride high, ride until the clouds break. You will learn to read rain. You will follow the white gravel it leaves. And so then the other poem I wanted to make sure that I shared is I think probably his most famous poem. It's a poem called Heartbeats. And I think I encountered it in an anthology before I found his book. Heartbeats. Work out 10 laps, chin up, look good. Steam room, dress warm, call home, fresh air. Eat right, rest well, sweetheart, safe sex. Sore throat, long flu, hard nodes, beware. Test blood, count cells, red thin, white low. Dress warm, eat well, short breath, fatigue. Night sweats, dry cough, loose stools, weight loss. Get mad, fight back, call home, rest well. Don't cry, take charge, no sex, eat right. Call home, talk show, chin up, no air. Arms wide, nodes hard, cough dry, hold on. Mouth wide, drink this, breathe in, breathe out. No air, breathe in, no air. Blackout, white rooms, head hot, feet cold. No work, eat right, CAT scan, chin up. Breathe in, breathe out, no air, no air. Thin blood, sore lungs, mouth dry, mind gone. 6 months, 3 weeks, can't eat, no air. Today, tonight, it waits for me. Sweetheart, don't stop, breathe in, breathe out. Yeah, that's Melvin Dixon. Yes. Yeah, so I'm glad that you got to be here with us to hear that poem and hopefully everything else, but I just, when I encountered that, I just never read anything like it before. It's such a gorgeous and heartbreaking thing. I mean, I almost started crying when I was reading it. It's like, just how do you make legible an experience like that? I mean, he did, but I don't get it. How it's possible. What was the first poem that you found from him? Was it the one from Sean?
So, yeah, Sean sent me the blood positive poem, but quickly I bought Love's Instruments, and Heartbeats was one of the poems that my students connected to the most, because it's not just that he's articulating this experience of being sick with AIDS, but that you feel the body in the poem. You feel the ba-bum, 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 the heart beating, and it rocks you, you know? But I knew that Melvin Dixon was important before I was told he was important. I felt that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, we talk about this quite a bit in our editorial meetings and the work we try to do. That so much of the energy in contemporary poetry, so much of it is coming from queer writers. It's like that's the engine right now to me and to the work we're doing. But you can see it in Melvin Dixon, right? Like, this isn't a new phenomenon. It's just now there's space being made for voices that used to not have space made for them in a way. And so once that space is made, you can't take it back because you can't unsee or unhear poems like this. Right, and so it's, I'm profoundly grateful that this book is going to be out in the world so that people can experience the scope of Melvin Dixon's work. And it really is like a granddaddy or something for some of the writers now. And they might not even be aware of it. They might not even know this is where they're getting it from. I mean, we see this quite a bit with poets writing like Lucille Clifton, but they haven't read Lucille Clifton. Or writing like Frank O'Hara, but they haven't read Frank O'Hara. Melvin Dixon's got a whole cohort of people writing after him that don't even know it. Yeah. But one of their teachers maybe did, or one of their friends maybe did. So there's a much longer sort of genealogy coming from this man who was only here long enough to write two collections of poems.
Right.
But
right.
They're significant collections of poems.
And a couple novels.
Yeah, right, right.
And
yeah,
he was a lot of essays.
Yeah, he was busy writing prose, too. So there's a bit of advice that we might take. I'm not suggesting that he shouldn't have done that, but I'm wondering how many poems would have been written if he hadn't been writing those novels. And so for poets, like, don't go over there. Don't go to that.
Stay with poems.
Stay with poems. I know there's money sometimes, but don't. Stay with poems. We need those more. Yeah, yeah. I was hoping that maybe you could read another poem.
Yeah, sure.
And we could talk about some of that, too.
You read another of my favorites, Getting Your Rocks Off. I love that one. So we know family doesn't always embrace queerness. So this is one of those poems. It's called Mother's Tour. At the Louvre, you find Mona Lisa gone secretly to Japan. Egyptian mummies closed, Greek statues so arresting and direct that you stumble. I catch you falling, but not the pain rising inside. Hours later, you can't walk. I translate in emergency, broken foot, sprained ankle. As the swelling eases, you limp to where my friend and I have slept, sightseeing us naked and embraced and chiseled in surprise breaks what your pill and gauze held tight, sends us packing separate souvenirs. His razor, my guidebooks, your figurines, cracked from travels, swelling our distance. Yeah. So, I mean, beyond someone being able to communicate illness and epidemic of illness and what that's done to so many, it's important for Melvin Dixon then in the, 70s or so, 80s to then also articulate, it's not easy being queer. It's not easy being black and queer. It's not easy sharing with your family the things that you love, the people that you love, because he's having her travel, you know, he's opening her up to these other experiences. Part of that is his own body and how his own body loves. And so I think it's vital for the poets writing today that they know that this poem existed. So how do we build upon what the ancestor Melvin Dixon did for queer verse, right? And queer black verse.
Yeah, thinking about that, I mean, I've been thinking about origin stories a lot because it's summer and it's like blockbuster season or, you know, lots of superhero movies. It's in my head, right? But there are origin stories and poems constantly, right? And one of those, I think, for every queer writer eventually has to reckon with what the family, how the family is there and what they're doing. And sometimes it's significant and supportive, right? And then other times it's one of the lifelong sort of traumas that people have to work through. And, you know, I was lucky because my mom was very supportive of everything that I did, but I can imagine another version of things, which would have been different, right? And Melvin Dixon's just given us a template for how to talk about that. Because once it's also a common experience, once it's an experience that's shared in a particular way, then it becomes even more difficult to write about because other people have been doing it. But centering, you know, centering the self over the family seems like a wise way to do it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good time for us to stop and ask if you all have questions, because I think what we're going to do is if you ask a question, you can get a copy of the magazine. I brought five of them. So if we get five questions, five people get magazines. Yeah, that side over there was like, let's go.
Sure, sure. So in the journal itself? Yeah, so it was a process of trying to craft a story that readers who'd never read Melvin before could follow and could feel a bit organically entrenched in, okay, who is this person? What kind of verse is he writing? What's important to him, right? And to give the reader an experience of him was very important too. So I'm hoping that that happened. I've heard, you know, gotten emails from a few people saying that the work felt important as they worked through the journal, and I'm thankful for that. I knew it was an important task, and I know we have a lot of readers for Poetry Magazine, so I just wanted to do a good job. And Adrian passed the job to me, and I was just grateful to have the opportunity to do it, to showcase his work, because his name isn't one I hear all the time. You know, it's just not, but it should be. And so hopefully things like this archival folio will help that to be the case. But it was a gratifying process to work with the poems and arrange them in an experience.
Yeah, this is part of a longer project that I started when I got to the magazine, of trying to get significant space for poets who have never been in the pages before. And there are so many of them. I have a really long list of, and you're not going to be surprised that they're all from marginalized communities, just about, like, people who just weren't given access to the pages, the kind of access they deserved while they were alive, mostly. And so Melvin Dixon was one of the people on. June Jordan was another one that we were able to do, and Azaka Shange was another one who we were able to do, and just like people, like, they're all my favorites, but also they should be here. They should be in this conversation in a way that makes plain their contributions, not just to the Black community or to their own spaces, but to the larger conversation of poetry, right? June Jordan's been writing about the stuff that people are writing about now. She wrote about it her entire career. And so people are now realizing, oh, in 1981, she's writing about Palestine and she's writing about Gaza, but she was doing it in 81. You know, so we look backward to understand now, you know. I saw that this young lady back here had her hand up. You have a question for us? What was he thinking about when he was writing those poems? Now, that's a really, really great question. I don't know, because I'll tell you what, if I did, I would write cool poems like he does. But I imagine that, you know, we all have stories that we want to tell, and poems are one of the ways we can do it. So I would imagine he was thinking about those stories. I mean, you read his notebooks. Did he say anything?
I did read his notebooks. He did not talk explicitly about, like, journaling about how he felt in writing the poems, but from reading all of his files, I felt that he knew time was precious, right? So it was like the necessity to write was very heavy with him. And I'm just glad he did. Otherwise, you know, Elizabeth Alexander and the other poets that compiled Love's Instruments might not have had much material to work with. So
yeah. This reminded me too that the book Change of Territory that we've been talking about was published by Callaloo, which Callaloo is a literary magazine that's focused on the arts of the Black diaspora. It's incredible. It's the oldest one in North America. And they, for a very brief time, published books of poetry too. So Elizabeth Alexander's book was on there. Her first book was a Callaloo book, and so was Melvin Dixon.
Hey.
You okay?
Producing art is a very vulnerable process, and I want to fear about being.
I told y'all he was a bad man, so I didn't see a note of fear. It was literally just him moving to the world. He had tons of syllabi he wrote for Queens College. He had his notes about his home and what he wanted to do to make it beautiful, and everything was very assured. He knew what he wanted to say and was very clear about it. If you go online to the Poetry Foundation's website and the magazine site, you'll see examples of revisions he made to one of the poems in here, and that he wrote out in longhand. And so check that out so you can see what kind of decisions he was making in writing the poems.
Yeah, thank you. I forgot to mention that. So the folio is online, and there's extra stuff that we didn't have room to publish. Visuals from his notebooks and things like that you can check out. Go ahead. Oh, That's such a beautiful question. Thank you for asking that. Do you want to start, or do you want me to?
Well, first of all, give them Love's Instruments, right?
That's right.
Like, I mean, so I've never been in education like you are, but it would be nice to have a little classroom library with all these books of queer writers that they could pick up and say, oh, wait, my story's in here, right? This person's going through HIV/AIDS now, and maybe that's going on with me. I need to think about it, talk about it, write about it. How do I do that? Oh, wait, here's somebody who's going to teach me how. And it's those lessons that can be pulled forward that are so important. So getting your library together so you can be telling these kids about what to read that will help them through.
Yeah. That's a really great place to start. Yeah, and thank you for the work you're doing with the kids, too. You know, I think that part of the joy of poetry for me is that it gives us power that we don't otherwise have, right? Like, it gives us the power to tell our own stories in a way so that somebody else doesn't tell them, because that's what happens, right? And encouraging young people to think about this as their story that they own, like, this is yours. You can shape it as you will. I don't know, that always, the permission is a big deal. And also knowing, because you've read Melvin Dixon and now you've read June Jordan, you've read these other poets who are speaking to a queer experience, that you're not alone, right? And it's not just in this moment that you're not alone, but this is historical. This is like the ancestors who have also had to deal with this in so many different ways. Let them know that they're not alone, mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, thank you for doing
There's
that.
There's a little sentence here in his speech. It says, if we don't write our books, they won't get written.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So hopefully these kids are out there writing their books.
It's like both a gift and a curse, right? Like, if we don't do it, we don't get up and do it, it doesn't happen. But that's really a gift. It's not a curse. It's just we're carrying it, right? I see you had your hand up earlier. Yeah. Yeah, so it's wild because there are more people writing and reading poetry now than there ever have been, but there are fewer resources directed toward poets than anything else. Right now, there are only a few organizations who financially support poetry in the U.S. Publishers, they don't make money off of it. And so it's almost like the action of it, the act of it being in the world is the most valuable part of it for people. It's not, you know, it's not a monetary thing. I think Ada Limone, who's the US Poet Laureate, might be one of the only people I know who makes a living as a poet, right? Everybody else has got some kind of other hustle, like, you know, multiple side hustles to survive, but it's part of who they are. And so we got the high sign that our time's almost up, but what I would say is that I am 100% convinced that what we need is somebody like Taylor Swift, not to just steal like the title of poet and put it in an album title, but to actually advocate for poems for the people who listen to them. Because poets advocate for it all the time, but we're talking to other poets. And so, you know, the choir has already been preached to. You know, it's like opening up that space outside of it. And if all it is they find Rupi Kaur, and that's as far as they go, that's fine. That's a kind of poet. Right? I would prefer that they went a lot further than that, but I'm just trying to get poets out there, whoever they are, whatever kind of work that they produce, you know? So I hope you all will buy a book of poems sometime soon.
Yes.
And support poets, right? Because we need it.
Mm-hmm. But, I do.
All right, so our time
They're
is
signing
up.
Signing upstairs on
yeah.
the ninth floor, I think.
Thank you so much. Did we
Thank
give
you
them,
all.
Did everybody get
blue?
Did we give all the books away? Okay. I have one more copy if somebody wants mine. Thank you all. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.